This week on Making Contact.
We've ended the marijuana boogie monster theory in California because of medical cannabis.
Could the war on marijuana finally be coming to an end? Californians will go to the polls this election day to vote on whether to legalize pot for all adults to smoke. Tax creation and jobs have dominated the debate, but at its roots, it's about ending a failed public policy that's put hundreds of thousands in jail and given them crippling criminal records.
Blacks make up 10% of LA County's population, but they're at 30% of the people arrested for marijuana possession.
On this edition, we look at the transforming culture that put Proposition 19 on the ballot and the changes that might take place if it's passed into law. I'm Andrew Stelzer, and this is Making Contact, a program connecting people, vital ideas, and important information.
It's a shame that as a young person that you don't really have a spot so you could go relax and just smoke weed and just chill. You really have to go find these little corners and shadows in the streets where you could come together with your people.
Froggy grew up in Los Angeles. His story is quite common. A young person of color living in an American city who, when he hangs out with his friends, sometimes smokes marijuana. They had to hide it from their parents, but more importantly, from the police.
Growing up in that environment, smoking weed is a norm. You know, it's not like, oh, you smoke weed, then I can't hang out with you. It was like if you don't smoke weed, like, who are you? Do you sure you live here? You know, it's like.
As he got older, Froggy began to question why they were having to hide, when as far as he could tell, they weren't really doing anything wrong, especially compared to some of the other things going on in the neighborhood.
I hate when people talk about imaging and stereotype people that smoke weed and already think of them as a criminal. Really, what is it that you're doing? Are you, like, you getting a gun, shooting people? Like, are you really going on a rampage? What is it that people do when they smoke weed, really? Because most of the time, it's more of a casual get together, talk to people, you know? It's more on a, like a socializing tip.
In June of 2010, Froggy was one of more than 15,000 activists of all stripes who gathered in Detroit for the second ever U.S. Social Forum. Among hundreds of workshops on issues like immigrants' rights, women's rights, the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and labor issues was a gathering titled Legalizing Marijuana for Social Justice. And the hot topic was California. The state that first legalized medical marijuana in 1996 now has a measure on the ballot that would legalize the sale of pot to any adult over the age of 21. While many other countries have decriminalized pot, California would be the first place in the world where it was completely legal. But despite the fact that marijuana prohibition affects just about everyone at the U.S. Social Forum, people weren't talking about it much. Call it the black sheep of social justice. Even though it puts thousands of people in jail, gets them kicked out of their homes and fired from their jobs, for some reason, people often just smile and giggle when it comes up in conversation.
A lot of us, people who think of themselves like serious political activists, it's just kind of like, it seems kind of trivial. You know, like, okay, yeah, you want to smoke pot, but like, you know, there's important work to be done in the world. And so I think that kind of turns off some like progressive people, but you know what? It's important work.
Jill Harris is the managing director of public policy for the Drug Policy Alliance.
I mean, I had someone say to me yesterday, well, but marijuana is legal, really, isn't it? And that's kind of what people think. And I was at a congressional hearing, and Congressman Rangel from New York said, well, I can't remember the last time.
The last time anyone was arrested in the city of New York for marijuana. I mean, smoking marijuana on the streets of Manhattan, you know, the cop may say, don't do it on my beat, but nobody's getting arrested.
That was a congressman, and in fact, the year before he said that, 46,000 people were arrested for marijuana in New York. New York City is the marijuana arrest capital of the world.
Yeah.
46,000 people were arrested, and our congressman is saying, well, I can't remember the last time someone was arrested for marijuana. So it was just this crazy disconnect that is present a lot.
In 2009, more than 850,000 Americans were arrested for marijuana violations, according to the FBI. That number is the second highest ever, and it means that more than half of the nation's drug arrests were for pot. It's a staggering statistic, but one that runs counter to popular wisdom.
And there are a number of places that have almost like a de facto decriminalization, right? So the cops don't really focus on it. People don't get arrested for it as much. But what that really means, though, is that it gives the police a lot of discretion so they can target the people they do want to arrest, you know? So it has this kind of insidious effect where they're still arresting tons of people. They're overwhelmingly targeting people of color. And yet, they can kind of say, well, you know, people don't really get arrested for it anymore. And people think that.
With several hundred thousand Californians using medicinal marijuana, the perception that pot is already basically legal is an attitude probably more prevalent here than in any other state.
There's a large group of people who think basically it's not a big deal right now. You know, you can basically possess marijuana in California. If you do get arrested, you just pay the $100 fine.
But it's far from the truth. According to Tamar Todd, a Berkeley, California-based attorney for the Drug Policy Alliance, that legend goes back more than 35 years, way before the legalization of medical marijuana.
What happened in 1975 was that the state legislature said basically you could not go to jail or prison for personal possession of marijuana, but they left it as a misdemeanor criminal offense. Following that in 1975, the number of arrests did dramatically decrease. But since then, over time, it's gone straight back up to where it was in 1975 and beyond. And when you look at law enforcement statistics within the state, in the last 10 years, or since 1990, actually, the arrest rate for all violent offenses has dramatically decreased. But for marijuana possession, it's gone up 127% in that same time period. So while crime has been decreasing in California and law enforcement has been not arresting people for violent offenses at the rate they once were, for marijuana, it's still skyrocketing, and many people are still being arrested and winding up with a criminal drug conviction on their record for possession of a small amount of marijuana.
My name is Marissa Garcia. I live in Santa Fe Springs, California, which is a suburb of Los Angeles, and I am 29 years old. It was actually the day before my 19th birthday, and I was driving with a couple of friends of mine. At the time, an ex-boyfriend of mine was driving, and unknown to me, he was driving on a suspended license. It was my vehicle that he was driving, and we pulled into a gas station to get some gas. I got out and I went to go pay the gas attendant for the gas, and when I came back, there was a police car parked behind my vehicle.
After running Garcia's ex-boyfriend's license, they arrested him. Then they began searching her car.
And they had found a small pipe that I had forgotten was even in there, a small pipe with ash in it. And the officer asked me who it belonged to, and I told him that it was mine. He wrote me a ticket. He didn't take it away from me. He didn't dump it out. He wrote me a ticket, and he sent me on my way. And this is the first and only time that I had been in trouble. It was my first time in court. I had no idea what I was doing. I mean, I knew that I had the right to a public defender, but I had no idea how to go about asking for one. So needless to say, I went up and I just pled guilty. They ordered me to pay over $400 in fines and court fees, which I gladly paid. I figured, you know, let me pay this fine. I broke the law, and it'll be over with. I can move on with my life. And I thought that's what I was doing until one day I had just started college. It was the spring of 2000. I was going to Cal State Fullerton, and it was my first semester. I just started, and I come from a family, I have a single mother, and I have three siblings who are really close in age. So we depend on financial aid in order to make college affordable for us. You know, at the time I was working full-time and everything, but there's no way that I could have been able to afford tuition and books and everything. So I was really counting on the financial aid. And this one day, I was here, and my mom was on her lunch break, and the mail arrived. And my mom brought me a letter, and she was really excited. She's, telling me that this is my financial aid award, and you know, let's open it together and see what award, like, I was awarded. And so we sat there on my bed and we opened it, and it was this letter saying basically that I had left a question blank, and it asked, do you have a drug conviction? So my mom, you know, just says, you know, just answer no and we'll send it back. And I just got kind of quiet, and I told her, you know, Mom, I hate to tell you this, but I don't know if I can answer no. And at the time, you know, I was still thinking, you know, I just got caught with a dirty pipe. There's no way that this is going to result in me losing financial aid.
What Garcia didn't know about is a 1998 law that mandated anyone found guilty of a drug-related offense would no longer be eligible for financial aid. For the first offense, the penalty period would last 1 year, 2 years for the second offense, and a third offense meant indefinite ineligibility.
I called the help number and I was telling my mom, it'll be okay, like this does not count. They don't mean me, you know, there's no way that they mean me. They must mean, you know, drug dealers or people who are, you know, selling drugs to children. There's no way that this applies to me. So I called the number, and lo and behold, they told me, you know, that you went to court, you pled guilty, you were convicted. You have a drug conviction, you have to answer yes, and you're not going to get financial aid.
Between 2000 and 2006, more than 200,000 students were denied financial aid because of drug offenses, many of them simple possession of marijuana. Garcia told her mother that she would take a semester off and work more hours at the flower shop to pay for college, but her mother insisted that she would not interrupt her studies.
And ultimately, I ended up putting a lot of my books on her credit cards. I mean, she, at the time, she was refinancing the house, and she gave me some money from that. And, you know, fortunately, I was one of the lucky ones. A lot of people, like my mom, if she didn't have those credit cards, if she wasn't in the middle of a refinance of the house, we wouldn't have had the money either. You know, and then the more that I started to learn about this law, the more my shame turned to anger, because I realized that if I had come from a family that was wealthier, that they wouldn't be able to do this to me, because if you're not eligible to receive financial aid, they can't take it away from you. So it's essentially just targeting middle and lower income families, who are the people that need financial aid the most.
Years after Garcia's experience, an ACLU lawsuit struck down part of the aid elimination provision. Students are still denied financial aid if they're guilty of a drug-related offense. However, the law is no longer retroactive to offenses committed before enrolling in school. Meanwhile, Garcia's criminal record still haunts her to this day.
I was unemployed for about a year and a half, and there was often times where I would see jobs that I was interested in, but it would state that, you know, they were going to do a background check, and I just, you know, I saw that and I just wouldn't apply for jobs that said that they were going to do that out of fear that, you know, I just was scared that they were going to look into my background and deny me based on that. So I just would avoid the situation, not even try. Because, you know, now I have a permanent drug conviction on my record.
Even if you do successfully get it dismissed, you still have an arrest record.
Tamar Todd from the Drug Policy Alliance.
That arrest stays on your record, and often questionnaires won't say, have you ever been convicted of an offense? They'll say, have you ever been arrested? So that sticks with you. Even if, you know, you're not guilty, you didn't do it, or you get the whole case dismissed, you still have an arrest record. If you hire a lawyer and you successfully get your record expunged, you may be able to answer no to some of the questions on those forms. However, whereas in the past, before everything was computerized and before the internet, you know, your original arrest and conviction might be buried in a courthouse somewhere. Now it's all online. So there's a lot of companies that keep track of that information prior to it being expunged and still have you in their database as having a criminal conviction, having an arrest for this drug offense. And then you're in the awkward position where you might answer no on a questionnaire, but they may pay $20 to some search database on the computer and find out that you do. And then you're definitely not getting the job or the apartment.
A drug conviction also keeps you from getting accepted into public housing. And if you already live there, you can be evicted. not only for your own drug use, but even that of a friend or family member that comes over to visit. And according to a Drug Policy Alliance study of marijuana possession arrests in California between 2004 and 2008, those federal policies have a vastly disproportionate effect on young people, people of color, and particularly African Americans.
In the largest 25 counties in California, in almost every single one, blacks are arrested at sometimes double, triple, and even quadruple the rate of whites are for marijuana possession offenses. And this is in the context of government statistics that show that blacks use marijuana at the same rate or even less than whites do.
There are similar statistics for other drugs, and those patterns repeat themselves all across the country. The trend has been so destructive to communities of color that the League of United Latin American Citizens of California and the state chapter of the NAACP endorsed Prop 19. The NAACP endorsement came over the objections of some black clergy members who believe legalizing drugs will be even worse for their communities.
I don't care what anybody say, marijuana is a gateway drug.
The chief spokesperson for the No on 19 campaign has been Bishop Ron Allen from the International Faith-Based Coalition.
It will cause workplace disruption. It will cause drug driving. And in fact, this act is so poorly written that it will cause the usage of marijuana among the youth to go up.
The opposition's primary claims that Prop 19 would allow people to drive high and go to work high have been debunked. The argument that's maintained traction is the simple moral belief that marijuana is a drug, that using it is wrong, and that legalizing it will increase usage. That fear has older voters polling as likely to vote against Prop 19. But younger voters, like these students at the University of California at Berkeley, are largely in favor of the ballot initiative.
I think it's about time California legalizes it and lets people, give people the freedom to choose whether to smoke or not.
I'm a supporter also of personal freedom.
I like the idea of taxing it. You know, the truth is people buy it and that's a ton of money just kind of not being taxed. And I like the idea of the money going to schools and, you know, and to hospitals and the like.
That last student's remarks about potential tax revenue from marijuana has been the primary message of the Yes on 19 campaign. We'll have more on that campaign strategy in just a minute. We'll be right back. You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information or for CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. Because of listeners like you, this show is distributed for free to radio stations in the U.S., Canada, and South Africa. To find out how to support us, download shows, or get our podcasts, go to radioproject.org.
According to the White House Office of Drug Control Policy, the drug cartels, the source of so much violence on both sides of the U.S.-Mexican border, get 60% of their revenue from marijuana sales in the United States.
That's Oakland City Attorney John Russo. He's one of dozens of current and mostly retired law enforcement officials who've come out in support of Proposition 19. With pot legalized, the argument goes, the price will fall and cross-border smuggling won't be profitable enough to continue. Russo calls Prop 19 a law and order initiative, which will help improve public safety and make for more efficient law enforcement.
Everyone can see that cannabis prohibition has failed to prevent widespread availability and use. Everyone can see that we arrest and criminalize tens of thousands of Californians each year for misdemeanor possession, thereby diverting police and prosecutors away from arresting and convicting violent criminals. That's not to mention the staggering human and financial costs that ordinary California families must bear when we lock up so many of our fathers, mothers, sons and daughters, cousins, friends, and other family members for bogus low-level marijuana possession crimes.
Russo also happens to work in one of the most open-minded places about marijuana in the entire United States. the city of Oakland has embraced the medical marijuana industry and has been benefiting from marijuana tax revenue. The city council recently approved zoning for large-scale growing warehouses. And then there's Oaksterdam University.
In terms of the environment, it turns out, ironically, that hemp also has one of the highest biodiversity grades of anything you could plant in the soil. It's better to core.
Oaksterdam opened in 2007. It's a school any adult can enroll in, where they can learn how to get into the medical marijuana industry. There's classes in anything from growing and trimming to running a dispensary. Jeff Jones is the chancellor at Oaksterdam University's Los Angeles campus and teaches cultivation classes at the Oakland School.
We've ended the marijuana boogie monster theory in California because of medical cannabis. Medical cannabis didn't cause the world to change, the sky to fall, or to see cannabis being more prevalent amongst our youth. Studies have shown since 1996 that most youth use has either been steady or has tapered off because it's not something that they're being drawn to.
To be sure, medical marijuana is still controversial in some parts of California, but the disagreements usually have more to do with the location of dispensaries near schools, homes, and churches, rather than the use of marijuana itself. In fact, most of the discussion about pot and about Prop 19 has been from the economic angle and how it could potentially raise more than $1 billion in tax revenue every year. Richard Lee is the founder and president of Oaksterdam University, and he's the primary funder for Prop 19. Lee spent about $1.5 million of his own money to pay signature gatherers for the ballot initiative.
Well, we're trying to target the different messages to the different groups, you know, to those that are having their social services cut. We talk about the tax revenue, to those who they're aware of lack of law enforcement protection, talk about how this will prioritize law enforcement better. Then there's those who have been negatively, personally affected, you know, cannabis prohibition, friends and family in jail. We can talk about getting those people out, the violence in Mexico. So, you know, tailor the message, protect the kids for the soccer moms better than prohibition does. Unions are a big part of the political landscapes. And so, you know, the fact that we got them on board by talking about jobs and is just part of politics, I guess.
With California's unemployment rate among the highest in the nation, Prop 19 has been endorsed by the statewide SEIU, the Northern California Longshore Workers, and the United Food and Commercial Workers Western Council. Dan Rush works statewide special operations for the UFCW Union Local 5.
We're organizing people all up and down the state in various jobs that didn't exist before, and they have some of them have funny names like bud tender and cultivator and... We have lab technicians, we have drivers, we have warehouse people. We'll create good, sustainable, single-earner jobs for people that can buy houses and raise families, jobs with health benefits, and jobs with pensions.
Despite the union endorsements, there are still fears that large corporate marijuana growing operations will surface if pot is legalized and could push the small growers and distributors out of business.
Hello, how are you doing? Are you a new patient?
No.
Do you want to come check out the babies first, and you can come check out medicine?
Cool. At the Humboldt Patient Resource Center, one of about 1,000 medical marijuana dispensaries in the state, grow room employee Andrew Dupree says many in the industry are torn about how to vote.
How would I vote? Oh, absolutely in favor of legalization. I believe that every man is a sovereign man, you know, that his rights should not be treaded on unless he bothers another man.
Have you spoken to people up here who are going to vote no or say they are?
Yeah, I have. I have.
What do they say?
Growers, dealers, you know, who are worried that they're not going to be able to make money anymore if it's legalized and the price drops significantly. They feel they're going to be, I guess you could say, their mom and pop type operations are going to be shut out.
That's just one of many concerns marijuana advocates have about the way Prop 19 was written. Some don't like that it allows the government to tax marijuana. Others are upset the legal age for consumption will be 21 and not 18, and it won't legalize smoking in the same room as minors, even though drinking alcohol and smoking cigarettes in front of children is totally legal. The new law might only allow 25 square feet of marijuana plants to be grown per household, not per person. There are so many objections, in fact, that Richard Lee was drowned out by booing people at the International Cannabis and Hemp Expo in San Francisco as he was attempting to debate Prop 19.
I think it does show that we did a good job of coming up with a reasonable compromise, you know, that we didn't make it too much one way or the other, because we did have to write something that would get passed by the voters. You know, we couldn't just put in everything we wanted.
We listened to polls, we listened to public opinion and focus groups when we drafted and worded Proposition 19.
Jeff Jones says the criminal justice angle is important, but it's not what builds support among the electorate.
Well, I think it's been a hard issue to prioritize because it really hasn't been the traction-oriented issue that's gotten this debate front and center. The revenue and the tax angle is really the thing that's brought this forward because of the current budgetary crisis. But while that's being debated, we have folks like the NAACP and others coming along making it a civil rights and a criminal justice issue. So it's not that we don't have bolstering support from our broad coalition representing that. It's just it's not always been the issue that tracks the best in the media or in the public opinion.
With only a few weeks to go before the elections, Prop 19 is leading at the polls by somewhere between 5 and 10%. In a move that may be a last-ditch effort to prevent the measure from passing, California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger signed a new law that changes possession of less than an ounce of pot to an infraction instead of a misdemeanor. The new law could bolster the argument that Prop 19 isn't needed, but advocates say full legalization is still necessary. According to the Drug Policy Alliance, that infraction will still be on someone's permanent record, and people still can't grow marijuana themselves. But it's a sign that things are changing. Nevada and Colorado may have their own legalization measures on the ballot in 2012, and medical marijuana is already permitted in 14 states and counting. Oaksterdam University's Jeff Jones says a cultural transformation is in the works.
The ripple effect of Prop 19 passing in California is going to have, an effect that we can't even yet estimate, because we're not even looking at the states. We're looking at international effects. Mexico wants to legalize and change the way that they're dealing with production and cultivation of cannabis and the penalties around it because of the drug cartel crime. Many states and countries in South America are in a similar state of affairs. They're looking at the failed policy of California and America being exported now to the world as not being helpful. And they're looking at avenues, but they can't stand up alone. And when Californians stand up, it may help the rest of America have to take a wake-up notice to the world saying, we don't want this either.
What if it fails?
We'll be in the same boat right back here again in 2 years trying another plan, because we're not going to give up. It's not necessarily right now a question of if it's going to happen. It's a question of when, because we're going to get over the wall. There's no question in my mind. It's just how long is it till they end this war?
That's it for this edition of Making Contact. For a CD copy of this program, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736. Or check out our website at radioproject.org to get our podcast, download past shows, or help make a difference by supporting our work. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.